On this Monday morning, we're all PhDs, piled higher and deeper. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. As streets and sidewalks slowly, slowly find their way back to black, we'll check in with Robert Maloney at the Emergency Operations Center in Baltimore for an update on plans to clear the snow, what city residents and businesses can expect on day two of the big dig. Then Justin Fenton of the Baltimore Sun and attorney Edward Smith walk us through last week's important developments in the trials of the officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray. And the Reverend Dr. Robert Franklin, the president emeritus of Morehouse College in Atlanta, joins me to talk about how Christians imagine justice. Plus, Ayaan Hirsi Ali has been identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an anti-Muslim extremist. She's scheduled to appear on the Baltimore Speaker Series tomorrow night. WIPR's Sheila Cast has a preview. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Our Town at the Vagabond Players. We'll start with these headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning on this very chilly and snowy Monday morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. If you're like me, you probably discovered a few muscles you had forgotten that you had, given the festivities of the weekend. But I hope you are safe. I hope you are beginning to get yourself dug out. On the phone with us now, Bob Maloney. He is the city's emergency manager. He's the guy responsible for citywide emergency preparedness for situations like we have been encountering the last 48, 72 hours. Bob, good morning. How you doing?
Good morning, good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. So we did set a record, 29.2 inches recorded at BWI. But this is a little bit different this year than, for example, Snowmageddon back in 2010, because we had a lot more experience, we had a lot more, and on this in this particular occasion, we have a lot more equipment able to be employed. Has that changed the strategy at all about how you prioritize what streets to get, when, et cetera?
No, the prioritization is, other than the change on doing the neighborhoods and the primary and secondary streets at the same time, the priority is on, of course, emergency situations, and then people who are marked as critical in getting them out of the emergency situation, people who are vent dependent and situations like that, the priority, and then it's we have a supermarket list. We knocked that out where we made certain that we could get every delivery truck in to restock. So there's a priority, but and it's just trying to get it done as fast as you can.
About how many streets do you think you have left to plow at least once at this juncture?
I don't have that answer. What I know is I spent last night driving around, and it seemed to me that we had plowed or made passable more of the side streets than not, and I expect today we'll continue to make some progress. We have to, we do have an operation today where we're going to have to get about 300 people to dialysis because they're due, and so what the community can expect to see today is many National Guards people transporting fire department personnel to actually go into some of the non-passable streets and carry people down to the intersections that we, thank God, have cleared, get them to dialysis and get them home. And we'll be doing that a lot today as well. We've done that before, so we had some practice with that one as well.
Mm-hmm. And MTA went into service, back into service about 10 minutes ago. It's going to run until around 9 o'clock tonight. First of all, it's free for those buses and that are running, but not all of them are running by any means.
Yeah, and that was huge for us. They really hunkered down and came up with a strategy. Free on some routes. It's not the tightest schedule. They knew it wasn't going to be, but their drivers and employees, got out of their houses. They got the staff there. They opened up the operation, and that to me is a great sign that we're recovering from this. But it's been less. Let's see. It stopped snowing at 11 o'clock on Saturday, so although the storm started on Friday, our dangerous weather didn't stop until, I guess, less than, 30 hours ago, maybe. So we got a lot of work to do, and we got a lot of digging out to do. So we'll be doing a lot of stuff today.
For those folks who are on one of those streets that has not yet been plowed even once, what's your message to them? What's your best speculation as to when all of the streets will have been at least subjected to one pass through of a plow?
Yeah, I can't speculate on the day. What I would say is that, you know, when it's all said and done, I think people will look back on it and say, you know, wow, they were able to get me out given the circumstances in several days, as opposed to, you know, a week to 10 days in similar circumstances, you know, previously. It's just so much snow. When you go the non-passable streets, if a car got stuck or the plow couldn't get through and we attempted once or twice, you know, you can see where you, if you, like, for instance, when you go up off of in Midtown, there's, you'll come across, you know, four or five streets which are perfect. The neighbors got out, they shoveled, we got there, it was coordinated. But then something went wrong on the next street over where a car might have gotten away or a plow couldn't get down. And then that street, you know, was lost. And now the effort and the time that it will take to go in and to uncover that, that's what we're up against on that technical snow removal. But and I guess what else I would say is, make no mistake, you know, we feel the pressure and we want to deliver not only so people can get to work, but so if there's a fire, an emergency on the block, we're not challenged by the snow. So right. We get it. And we're on it. We're going to be working super hard today to serve the citizens.
All right. Bob Maloney joins us from the city's Emergency Management Center. He is the city's emergency manager. Bob, I know you got a busy day ahead of you as you've had for the last couple of days. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Now an update on the trials in the officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray. Justin Fenton joins me on the phone. He's a reporter with the Baltimore Sun, and along with fellow Sun reporter Kevin Rector, he has been doing outstanding work covering the many twists and turns of the trials. Justin, good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine, thanks. Edward Smith also joins us by phone this morning. He is an attorney in private practice here in Baltimore, and he has been one of our invaluable go-to guys for legal analysis and commentary. Good morning, Eddie. How you doing, man?
Oh, good morning, Tom. Good morning, Justin, and good morning to the radio audience.
So, Justin, prosecutors have changed their minds about compelling Officer William Porter to testify. Originally, they had insisted that he testify in the trials of Cesar Goodson and Alicia White, but they've revised their strategy, haven't they?
Well, they tried to. So this gets very complicated. I'll try to explain it as clearly as I can. Back in the fall, the prosecutors were asked sort of how they wanted to proceed with the cases and to lay out a schedule for them. And what they said was that Officer Porter was a critical witness in the cases against Goodson and White, and so they wanted to try him first and then try the other two officers and have him appear as a witness at those trials. Everything got thrown off once his trial ended in a mistrial, and his charges are still hanging out there. They're still pending, and so they had to ask the judge to compel him to testify, make him testify under immunity against the other two officers, which he immediately appealed to the Court of Special Appeals. And the Court of Appeals has not made a decision on that, and it's sort of locked up those next two trials. They are not going to proceed until the Court of Special Appeals has made a decision about whether he should be forced to testify. So while we were waiting for that to happen, the prosecution came back to the table and said to the judge, you know what, we want to actually call him as a witness in all of the trials. And so we want him to be compelled, and we want you to give him immunity in those cases as well. And they asked the judge for that last week. They were denied that motion. The judge said that he thought it came off as a potential stall tactic, and so they have to proceed with the other three trials, and that means the next one could begin as soon as next month.
Eddie Smith, was Judge Williams' order for Mr. Porter to testify, was that done on somewhat unprecedented legal grounds? I mean, is there a particular body of case law that the Court of Special Appeals is going to base their decision on when they decide whether or not Porter has to testify in these other trials?
Well,
first of all, Tom, it's not unprecedented. We have a statute in Maryland out of courts and judicial proceedings, which is 9123, which indicates that a judge may order a person who evokes his Fifth Amendment right not to testify to testify as long as what he says cannot be used directly or indirectly against him in a subsequent proceeding, either before a grand jury or in a jury trial. The case involving the Supreme Court comes out of a case called Perez versus the United States, an 1824 case with Judge Joseph Story. There was a man who was standing trial for a capital offense, and the judge declared a mistrial. And that case stands for the proposition that even though it's double jeopardy to try a person who's charged with a crime, in some instances when a judge decides that there's a manifest necessity for a mistrial, and he does that or she does that in a way that is reasoned, then the Fifth Amendment right to testify in double jeopardy is trumped. So there's plenty of cases along the line, I've had some myself, where mistrials are declared and it's perfectly all right to go again.
Justin, you wrote a terrific article. You've written a bunch of terrific articles, but the one that was really quite striking a couple of weeks ago, you found a juror in the Porter trial who remained anonymous but agreed to speak with you and give you insight into how the jury deliberated, what the conclusions of their deliberations were on the four charges facing Officer Porter. On two of the charges, involuntary manslaughter and second-degree assault, they leaned towards acquittal, and on two of them, reckless endangerment and misconduct in office, they leaned towards conviction. Did the jurors change their minds a lot during these deliberations? What did you find out when you talked to this juror?
Yeah, I mean, initially this vote count was not known. It's not uncommon after a hung jury for the prosecutors or the defense or reporters such as myself to talk to the jurors and say, hey, what went on in there? But the judge in this case asked the jurors not to speak. He didn't order them not to speak, but he asked them not to speak. He was afraid of the implications that it might have on the other trials. The juror we spoke to said that it was a very emotional time in there, and that they did go back and forth. This juror told us that they thought that if they had continued deliberating, they might have even reached a verdict. But the jury overall told the judge that they were hopelessly deadlocked after about 3 days of deliberation. So they were one vote away from complete acquittal on the most serious charge, and they were just two votes away from conviction on the misconduct charge at the time the mistrial was called. So Officer Porter, as of right now, has a retrial scheduled for June.
Okay. Well, Justin and Ed, I'm sorry that's all the time we have this morning. I appreciate the insight, and you guys stay warm and don't shovel too hard. Thanks so much for being here.
You do the same, Tom.
Okay. Justin Fenton is the courts reporter for the Baltimore Sun, Edward Smith, an attorney in private practice. More on the trials as they continue here on Maryland Morning and on WIPR. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. It's time now for another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Next month, ICJS will inaugurate a three-part lecture series on the theme of imagining justice in Baltimore. A Christian, Jewish, and Muslim scholar will each address the question of how each religious tradition refracts and understands the notion of justice. In light of the wrenching events in Baltimore last spring, the Institute is hoping to bridge ethnic, socioeconomic, and religious divides to deepen and enrich appreciation for the place of justice seeking in different faith traditions. My next guest this morning is the first speaker on this new series, and he'll speak from the Christian perspective. The Reverend Dr. Robert M. Franklin is President Emeritus of Morehouse College in Atlanta. He's a professor of moral leadership at Emory University and the director of the Religion Department at the Chautauqua Institution in Chautauqua, New York. His latest book is called Crisis in the Village, Restoring Hope in African American Communities. Dr. Franklin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very pleased to be with you.
Delighted to have you here. Let's start with a clip of Dr. King speaking in March of 1965 at the end of the march from Selma to Montgomery. This was the famous march that began with the horrible events on the Pettus Bridge and then finished in Montgomery, Alabama. This is what Dr. King had to say on that day.
How long will justice be crucified and truth buried?
Yes, sir.
I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long,
no,
because truth pressed to earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How long?
Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes, sir.
The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Dr. Franklin, I mean, do you think at this juncture in history that people of color in this country, in light of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, the massacre in Charleston, this horribly long list, do you think folks are seeing and sensing in a visceral way that the arc is bending towards justice?
I think there's real questions now about which way the arc is bending. In fact, there's enormous evidence to suggest it is bending toward justice and greater equity. We're a long way from the mid-1960s and the struggles and the efforts to dismantle, legalize segregation, et cetera. We see President Obama, we see in wonderful symbols of American racial progress in every sector of society. On the other hand, there's so many instances and incidents that remind us that there is a lot of work to do. And I think one of the heavy lifts for all of us is moving from this public to a more private embrace of the agenda of racial justice and equity. And that's where I think that many of the listeners and followers of Dr. King are really grappling with how do we make that shift. Yes, laws, public policy, important, necessary, but not sufficient. There has to be what Dr. King called a revolution of values. And so much of that happens in more private spaces, in the heart, in the suburbs, and in boardrooms and locations where there's little diversity and inclusion at this time.
I wonder, do you think there's even a consensus about what justice means? There are so many people, African Americans and Caucasians alike, who wanted to declare a post-racial universe once President Obama was elected in 2008. And I think pretty much everybody understands that that's not by any means the case these 8 years later.
No, I think that's right. I think the debate about the meaning of justice is a longstanding American tradition. It's an American habit, and it's actually a wonderful habit that goes back to the very beginnings of the nation, even as young Thomas Jefferson was left to pen the words of the Declaration of Independence with inputs from wise and older leaders like Ben Franklin and John Adams and others. We've grappled with what that means. We've looked at the very author, Jefferson, and his complexities in history and recognized that while wonderful language, American promises about equality and inclusion and fair treatment for all have always reflected these discrepancies, contradictions, and gaps. And I think, you know, the history of American social movements, the women's movement, civil rights movement, movement for LGBT justice, continues to try to close the gaps and to try to reconcile what the Harvard historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. once called reconciling the discrepancies between America's rhetoric and America's reality.
on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. This is our monthly segment called Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. My guest this morning, the Reverend Dr. Robert M. Franklin, President Emeritus of Morehouse College, now on the faculty of Emory University and directing the religion program at the Chautauqua Institution. He's joining me on the line from Atlanta. As we saw Dr. Franklin here in Baltimore with the death of this young man, Freddie Gray, who came from a neighborhood called Sandtown, Winchester. This neighborhood is just plagued with all sorts of systemic problems, and there is this prevalence of hopelessness and despair on the part of many of the folks who live there and have grown up there. I'm reminded of the great spiritual Guide My Feet. You know, guide my feet while I run this race, because I don't want to run this race in vain. I just wonder, what role do religious communities play in addressing this sense of hopelessness and this notion that the race is, in fact, being run in vain?
When I speak there in Baltimore, I'm going to invite and challenge the religious community to reread Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail. I think that's an exceedingly important letter for our time. Part of what he does there is he expresses his disappointment with the faith community and yet challenges them to claim their true moral mantle, to project a vision of a beloved community. That was a favorite metaphor of his, beloved community. And I have to say that while I will talk about what the interfaith, multi-faith community can and should do with respect to projecting visions of a better Baltimore, a more equitable, just, and inclusive Baltimore, providing some suggestions and hints about best practices in diversity and inclusion language and practice, I'll also talk about the role of the arts, the role of the non-religious community in helping us advance toward justice. But I'm especially interested in the arts, the way in which visual artists, musicians, rap artists, hip-hop artistry really points us to some important steps, like breaking the silence on these issues that we haven't talked much about. Secondly, upsetting the current equilibrium so that we get people's attention. We see that happening in places like Baltimore. Sure. In addition, it's important to probe the questions of how did we get here? And most importantly, Dr. King's question that became the title of his very last book in 1968 was, where do we go from here, chaos or community? And so I'll be outlining some diagnostic exercises for the business community, the higher education community, the faith community, and the arts community, and others, but also making some suggestions about how we can go forward together.
You know, Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail, which you've written a foreword to in a new edition fairly recently, I'm struck when he talked about this notion of outside agitators, because that's one of the issues he was addressing when he's in prison there in Birmingham, and folks in that community saying, well, why is this guy from Atlanta coming over here and raising a ruckus? What's your take on the Black Lives Matter movement, which has been described as leaderful, meaning that there are many different leaders rather than leaderless? Obviously, in the 1960s, Dr. King was the focal point and the singular leader of the movement. Folks have commented that the current civil rights actions are being taken by a whole panoply of people. What's your understanding of how effective it is now and how it differs from the days of Dr. King?
I think the jury is still out on how effective it is. It is certainly doing the important work of breaking the silence and of calling attention to the unfinished agenda, particularly with respect to police-community relations. The question is, can that movement and will that movement mature in ways that enable it to be an important voice of conscience for the larger society across time? Is it sustainable? We don't know that yet. I hope it will be, because I think that the earnestness and the wonderful multiracial, multicultural creativity that has been unleashed by Black Lives Movement is something that could be good for our democracy. I do think that There are certain disciplines, however, with respect to moral leadership. And my hope is that we will see this manifest. That is, for instance, paying due deference to traditions that precede you, learning from the elders like Dr. King, like Rabbi Heschel, like Dorothy Day, and so many other important activists who were part of the American democratic protest tradition. There's also the importance of building broad and inclusive coalitions. And so those, I think, are still tests for that movement. But in terms of its indignation, its impatience, its passion for justice, its willingness to work with anyone, and its courage, I'm very inspired at this time.
There is a growing chorus, it seems, of younger African-American scholars. I'm thinking of people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, a fellow here at Hopkins, a political scientist named Lester Spence. There's a guy named Jamie Wooten, who's the founder of a thing called KineticsLive.com. And they are particularly disenchanted and almost angry with the African-American church. They talk about the notion of preacher pacifiers, pacifying instead of politicizing people to and animating them towards action. How do you respond to those critiques?
They are, for the most part, very thoughtful and, I think, helpful correctives to a religious culture and religious leaders who are far too comfortable with their relationship with the political and economic status quo. So when they call attention to contradictions and challenges, even within the black church community, for instance, the freedom and rights of women in the churches, how black churches treat and relate to gays and lesbians, how the church responds to young people in terms of including them, and the church's social justice voice on critical policy issues. They're challenging the church in the same way, I would argue, that Dr. King did in that letter from Birmingham Jail. So those, I think, are well-placed. They are valuable and redemptive if black church leadership, which is largely middle-aged and male, is willing to open their ears and engage these voices.
The Reverend Dr. Robert M. Franklin is the James T. and Berta R. Laney Professor of Moral Leadership at Emory University in Atlanta and the Director of the Religion Department at the Chautauqua Institution. He will be the first speaker on the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies series called Imagining Justice in Baltimore. He will speak from the Christian perspective. Later in the year, Dr. Mark Gopin and Najiba Saeed will address the same topic from the Jewish and Muslim perspectives. Dr. Franklin's presentation will be held on Thursday, the 11th of February at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African-American History and Culture. It starts at 7 o'clock. We've got a link to details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Dr. Franklin, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you next month.
Looking forward to being there, Tom. Thank you.
This has been another discussion in our series, Living Questions, in which we explore all aspects of the role of religion in the public sphere. Living Questions is produced by WIPR in partnership with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. You can hear this and all of the conversations we've had in our Living Questions series when you visit our website, wipr.org/livingquestions. I'm Tom Hall. We're delighted that you have joined us this morning for Maryland Morning. Lots more coming up. Stay with us. The Vagabond Players in Baltimore are presenting an American classic, Our Town. It's a play that gets produced a lot. In her weekly theater review, Maryland Morning theater critic Jay Wynn Russick tells us,
Thornton Wilder's Our Town is the most produced American play. It's on stage somewhere every single day. So it's not surprising that people think they know it. Our Town, that folksy play that gets done in high schools. But Our Town is much more than that. It's a play that cuts to the core of what it means to be human, to experience life. And it's a play that was so daringly experimental when it debuted in 1938 that it changed the face of American drama. A production that gets all of that, or even most of it right, will shake you up in the opening scene and move you to tears by the end. Director Eric C. Stein and his cast have a firm grip on Our Town at the Vagabond Players. Much of the groundbreaking nature of Our Town had to do with the way it's staged, essentially on a bare stage without props. The audience fills in the blanks. The character of a stage manager was also groundbreaking. He serves as a narrator, introducing the characters and the action. Josh Shoemaker plays the stage manager with the amiable calm of a schoolteacher.
The name of the town is Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, just across the Massachusetts line. Latitude 42 degrees 40 minutes, longitude 70 degrees 37 minutes. The first act shows a day in our town. The day is May 7th, 1901. The time is just before dawn.
The story that the stage manager tells seems simple enough. A pair of teenagers, next-door neighbors, George Gibbs and Emily Webb, fall in love, marry, and, well, just in case you aren't familiar with the play, I'll leave it at that. In George and Emily's first scene, William Meister's George is bashful, a bit awkward, a good kid. Ryan Gunning's Emily combines a youthful spirit with the slightly proud air of the smartest girl in school.
Gee, it's funny, Emily. My window up there, I can just see your head nights when you're doing your homework over in your room.
Why, can you?
You certainly do stick to it, Emily. I don't see how you can sit still that long. I guess you'd like school?
Well, I figure it's something you have to go through.
Yeah.
I don't mind it, really. It passes the time.
Kudos also to actress Gunning for her handling of her last scene. A scene that requires her to portray Emily at 12 and as a grown-up, watching and commenting on her younger self. The entire play builds up to this, and Gunning strikes a fine balance between the brash 12-year-old and the somber adult. Among the production's other nice touches is that William Meister's real-life father, Chip, plays George's father, the town doctor. Ryan Gunning's father also has a small role. It's just the kind of thing that might happen if our town were produced in a town as small as Wilder's fictitious Grover's Corners. Director Stein adds a few little embellishments, some sound effects, and one bit I especially liked. George mimes giving Emily the cherry off his ice cream soda in the scene where they fall in love. Not everything comes off with this much grace, but Stein and company respect the purity of the play, and in the process come up with a production that honors Thornton Wilder's achievement. The self-reflexiveness of our town, the way it never lets us forget we're watching a play instead of settling for naturalism, doesn't seem unusual today. That, in itself, is a tribute to the play's impact. The Vagabond Players is celebrating its 100th anniversary with revivals of some of its best-loved plays. It's been almost a half century since the theater last produced Our Town, but it still feels right at home.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russett calls Maryland Morning home every Monday morning. Our Town continues at the Vagabond Players in Baltimore until February 7th. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Next week, Judy tells us about an all-female version of Shakespeare's As You Like It at Baltimore's Center Stage. Lots more ahead on the program today. Stay with us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall.
If you have thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. The controversial scholar Ayaan Hirsi Ali is speaking at the Baltimore Speakers Series tomorrow night. She grew up in a conservative Muslim family in Africa, and as a teenager, she was a devout Muslim. Now she's an atheist. My colleague Sheila Cast asked her to help us understand how her faith evolved.
Well, I think you could summarize my life journey in, you know, the physical journey where I was born in Somalia and lived in Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Kenya, the Netherlands. That is going from location to location. But as that was happening, I was also evolving intellectually and, you know, asking questions about what's right, what's wrong, discovering and understanding theories about humanity and how to, you know, organize society. And these organizing principles, the ones that I grew up with, were Islamic and Islam inspired. And when I went to the Netherlands, I discovered that there were other ways of organizing society. And in that journey, I thought, and I still think I've come to conclude that man-made laws are superior to divine law for the simple reason that, you know, you can't as a human being interfere with or change divine law. But as human beings, as you get on, you can deal with conflict and conflict resolution, and through collaboration, you can change things. So I have now come to live and understand that the separation of religion from politics is the key ingredient for a better, more peaceful, and more prosperous civil life between human beings and nations.
But it seems to me that your public advocacy has gone further than that, in that you're calling for what you call a reform of Islam, not just keeping it out of politics, but a pretty thorough change of the religion itself.
Yes, I'm doing that since, you know, the Arab Spring of 2010. I published a book saying Islam is hopeless if you're a good person and you're born into Islam. The only way out is to leave it. And fast forward to the time when the Arab Spring erupts, what I see, along with everybody who was paying any attention, was that there are large numbers of Muslims in Arab countries that are okay with being religious. They are Muslim and they identify as Muslim, but they want a clear separation of religion from politics. And in order to achieve that, they have to be able to have a narrative that's consistent, that is coherent, and that is compelling to give a rebuttal and to debunk the ideas of the fundamentalists, or the ones we've come to call extremists. And in order to do that, you have to acknowledge what it is within Islamic doctrine that needs to be rendered obsolete. And in my book, Heretic, published last year in March, I sort of identify the five key points within Islam that if people distance themselves and repudiate these five key concepts, you could still be a Muslim and live in peace with other Muslims and the rest of the world.
Well, you have said that you no longer believe what your father taught you, that Islam is a religion of peace. I'm trying to understand, do you see violence like the shootings in San Bernardino, the killings in Paris, as a perversion of Islam, or as inherent in Islam?
These teachings are inherent in Islam. And again, as we all know, especially in the monotheistic religions, these were not religions that were founded on peaceful grounds. They were, the question that the religion of Islam is a religion of peace is something that is very modern and new, and it's false. Islam is a religion of both peace and war. But in Islam, understanding of peace, you get to a place of peace only when people have accepted Islam. As long as people reject Islam, or as long as they don't, as Muslims, they don't apply it literally, there is no peace. There'll always be jihad. There'll always be commanding fights and forbidding wrong. And that is the part of Islam that today is widespread, is organized, that is troublesome, and of which organizations like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, all of those brands that I don't know how familiar your listeners are with, but that is coming from that aspect of Islam. And the peaceful Muslims and the peace-loving Muslims are, first of all, the largest number of victims. But I also think it is their responsibility to say, we have to draw the line somewhere. And so they have to throw out these five aspects. And if Muslims fail to do that, then, you know, Muslims will have to find themselves on a war footing with the rest of the world.
Do you see Islam at war with the world?
At this point, the leaders who emphasize jihad, holy war, and who emphasize the literal meaning of the Quran and the actions of the Prophet Muhammad, they have plunged most of the world, most Muslims, into war. And every time, you know, we talk about counterterrorism measures, we talk about the situation in the Middle East and South Asia, we talk about economic and political issues, military issues, but ultimately we cannot escape the fact that there is a growing group of Muslims who want to impose Sharia on their own societies and the rest of the world, and who are conducting campaigns of jihad. And so sooner or later we have to face that.
Well, just quickly, I then need to ask you, because as you know better than I, some of comments like that are the reason that some Muslims contend that you are an Islamophobe. And indeed, 2 years ago, when Brandeis University was about to offer you an honorary degree, it decided not to, saying that some of your public statements had been, quote, inconsistent with Brandeis University's core values. How do you address that?
I address it by pointing out to the effort of other Muslims who are embarrassed and ashamed by what is done in the name of their religion, like the Muslim Reform Movement, just now established in Washington, D.C. And I also want to remind listeners that during that Brandeis incident, the Islamic State had not hit the headlines as much as it did now. And since then, it is almost impossible for Muslims to escape the reality that they have fellow believers that inflict pain, that sell women and girls into slavery, that kill people in places of worship, in schools, Peshawar, and it is in Garissa in Kenya, Peshawar in Pakistan. They can't escape these realities. So for those of us who are born into the faith, who can't escape that reality, who understand the doctrinal underpinnings for this violence, we have no other choice but to face it. And I work closely now with more and more Muslims who see that and who are looking for ways of trying to improve that from the inside.
Much to talk about when you are here in Baltimore. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Ayan Hirsi Ali will be speaking tomorrow night at the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. She's a fellow with the Future of Democracy program at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. She spoke with Midday host Sheila Cast, who is the host also of the Speaker Series. That's it for us today. Join us Wednesday when my guest will be Democratic mayoral candidate Nick Mosby. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.